Hello and welcome to the MaxMoo podcast. This is Lindsay Behrens, the founder of MaxMoo, a website, email, newsletter, and podcast about New York City theater, mostly theater beyond Broadway. Today's podcast is an interview with a New York City theater artist. It's a format that I'm interested in exploring more on the podcast. I've temporarily subtitled the series Playwrights and Performers, Not Producers, because I think in New York City theater, we often hear from producers about shows that they're creating and marketing, but we don't necessarily get to hear from the artists behind the work about their creative process and the journey of becoming a theater artist and living and working in New York City as a theater artist. So I'm hoping this will become a more regular feature on the MaxMoo podcast. On today's episode, we chat with writer and performer Peter Michael Marino. Peter conceived of and wrote the musical adaptation of Desperately Seeking Susan using music from Blondie, the rock band headed by Debbie Harry. It opened on the West End in London in 2007 and then closed about a month later. As you might imagine, that was a difficult experience to endure, and Peter tells us all about developing that show and suffering through the stages of grief when it closed, then turning it into a hit in Japan, and the redemption of writing and performing a one-man show about that experience called Desperately Seeking the Exit. We also talk about the shows that inspired his career and what he did in the early days, including spending time as a dancer on Club MTV. Peter is performing Desperately Seeking the Exit, the one-man show he created in New York City on March 22nd and 23rd at 8 p.m. He will also be performing the show at the Orlando International Fringe Theater Festival later this year. Thanks again for joining the MaxMoo podcast. Enjoy the show. Let's chat about the stuff you have coming up.
All right, let's do it.
But let's get your background first. Where are you from?
I grew up in Queens, and I lived there until I was 12, and then I lived in Long Island for 6 long years, and then went to school in Buffalo and moved directly to New York City.
Growing up in the city, did you have contact with the theater here?
None. It was amazing. I mean, my parents still to this day, it was a train ride away. It was obvious that I was like smitten with entertainment. You know, why did we never, you know, back in those days, they used to have like, there would be like little live shows before the movies, mm-hmm. I remember. And I remembered seeing some live show. They did like a little Hansel and Gretel before like Disney Cinderella or something. And I was like, how are those people doing that? How did they get up there? I want to do that. You know, it's that story. So no, the first time I ever saw a Broadway show was on a school trip in junior high school to see Frankenstein with Keith Carradine, or one of the Carradines was in it. And that show is notorious for opening and closing on the same night.
Oh.
And that pretty much...
And you saw it.
And I saw it. And I remember it. Like, I could see the entire show happening in front of me. I totally remember everything about that show. It was incredible. The biggest thing was the end of the show, the castle blows up, and like they had some kind of great rigging where these giant rocks were falling and fire, and it was a turntable. Oh, it was fantastic.
And you knew this is what you wanted.
Totally
to do.
Knew. Yeah. And then that sort of began my terrible habit of cutting school to come into New York to see shows.
Wow.
Like saving my lunch money. Or maybe taking extra money out of my mom's purse while she was sleeping.
listening, Mom.
Yeah, she is. To sneak into New York and see shows. And back in those days, too, there were, like, truant officers who literally would, like, see, like, a 14-year-old online at TKTS on a Wednesday afternoon and, like, say, why are you not in school?
Wow.
And be like, this is for my school. This is my school project.
And what was it about the theater that just attracted you to it so quickly?
Gosh, I wish I knew. You know, I guess initially I'm such a visual person. Like, I actually went to school to be a theater designer, but I found I wasn't really very good at math. And back in the 80s when I was in school, like, there weren't computers, so you had to know math to design sets and lights. I think just like seeing beautiful things on a stage stuck with me more than the storytelling in a weird way. And then once I kind of got over that and realized that like plays were about things and, you know, musicals had meaning and all that. very early on, that stuck with me as well. You know, truthfully, I guess this is really weird. The thing I'm just remembering this now. Really think the one show that actually solidified that I'm going to do this and this type of theater in a weird way was Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
Oh, really?
I was online at TKTS with my buddy, and these two quirky people approached us with flyers, because then again, back in the day, people would do that, mm-hmm. actually approach you with flyers for their show and say, get offline, come to our show, bring it to the theater. What was that theater they were at? It was right by Washington Square, Provincetown Playhouse, perhaps. And, you know, and let us know what you think of the show afterwards. Well, those people were Andy Halliday and Julie Halston.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, there we are knocking on the door, and we're backstage, and there's Charles Bush taking off his makeup and saying, oh, did you enjoy the performance? And, oh, my gosh. It was like nothing I've ever seen, you know, because they used found objects in the set, and it was campy, and it was daring, and it was dirty, and it was ridiculous, and paid homage to all these, you know, old movies. It just, I fell in love with it. Cut to about 15 years later, there's Julie Halston doing the first reading of my play, Hollywood Nurses.
Wow.
That was completely inspired by, you know, Times Square Angel and Vampire Lesbians. And then there's Carl Andress, who's been directing all of Charles's last few shows, directing my show. I mean, it was... I think I tell Julie Halston that story all the time, and she never gets tired of it.
<I'm sure. laughs>
She had
amazing.
An effect on me in some way. Yeah, yeah.
So what was your first experience participating in the theater?
Oh, just, you know, junior high school, being in Oklahoma or something like that.
Yeah.
Bye-bye Birdie, you know, all the stuff you do in high school.
And then when did you start writing your own stuff?
Well, I really never wanted to write. When I was in college, I remember that my professor saying, you should take my playwriting class. And I said, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to write stuff. I want to bring stuff that's written to life. I've always been a fan of, like, recycling stuff as well. It's kind of my thing, I guess. So, you know, I didn't really think much about writing. And then I got into doing improv with Theater Sports when I first moved to New York. I was very fortunate to be in that company. And doing a lot of improv with them inspired my creative partner, Sheila Head, and I to create a new show called Character Witness that was sort of like a soap opera with five or six actors, each playing 10 different people who lived in this fictional town called Fictition. And the audience determined where we were going, where we were going to go every week and what was going to happen. It was, you know, this is before, gaming where you had that control, or The Sims, or I think we did it before anybody. There was no competition at that time. And out of that show, in that show, I had a character named Lance Jonathan, who was an extremely optimistic, untalented chorus boy who was obsessed with Broadway. And audiences just really liked this character. So I wrote a show for him, which was a parody of cabaret shows.
I see.
Which people also weren't doing at that time. Again, this is before, like, South Park and stuff, where people just make parodies of things. And that show just kind of, I guess, put me on the map, because I literally remember, like, stage manager coming down and going, blah, 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 is here from blah, blah, blah casting, and blah, 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 is here from, and I go, well, they didn't call me back, so there's no room for them. I can't help it if we're sold out. I mean, it was like, wow. What the hell was I thinking? But I really didn't know what to think, because I couldn't believe that something I was doing was getting any kind of attention. But it was because it really did completely spoof every trope that you see in every cabaret show.
Uh-huh.
Plus, the character was insane and I guess somewhat likable.
Funny.
So then that led to a spinoff, and then that led to a Bistro Award, and that led to other stuff. And I went, I guess I'm a writer.
And was that after college? So...
Yeah.
And so you went to college in Buffalo, and then did you just come right to the city and say, I'm going to get started in theater?
Yeah, I was actually doing Shakespeare in the Park in college in Delaware Park, which is how I got my equity card. And I was backstage reading Backstage. I don't know how I got it in Buffalo, but somehow I found a copy of Backstage. And I remember looking at one of the other cast members and circling this ad, casting call for dancers for MTV, new dance show, Club MTV. I said, I'm going to get that show. And I moved to New York a week later, and I got that. I got that show. It was on the first season, maybe the first two seasons of Club MTV.
Wait, it was like, what did you do on that show?
Danced. You just went to Palladium. They paid you to go to Palladium with five different outfits a day, and you danced all day. It was like American Bandstand.
Uh-huh.
that was also the first time I met Debbie Harry, which is interesting.
Oh, wow.
And I also once got to introduce Jelly Bean Benitez, who was Madonna's mixer at the time. So, like, who knew that it would all wind up coming back, you know, 20 years later. But that was my first job, was as a dancer in that. Then I was doing theater sports. And then I was doing regional theater, doing all those things that character actors do, like Greater Tuna and stuff like them, playing Snoopy. And then while I was playing Snoopy, actually, I circled an ad in backstage for Stomp. And I said, I'm going to get that show. And then I came back and I got Stomp.
Wow. So when you moved to the city after college, what were your expectations for what it would be like to be a professional actor, performer, writer in New York City?
You know, I don't think they really taught us, and perhaps they still don't, teach theater students anything more than the craft of acting and the craft of, you know, directing or whatever specific area it is. The business part is always non-existent. It was at the time. I mean, I know people now who graduate from, you know, great schools and have no sense of business. So you don't think of it as a business. You think of it as, like, I love to do this. And you find people that are like you, and you do it. My college friends, we did form a theater company and did produce a bunch of shows without realizing we were producing. You know, it was just like, we want to do this. You know, learning how to get the rights to something, learning how to get insurance, learning how to book a space, all that kind of stuff. We just did it really early on, so it just became easier and easier as we went on. But then you just assume, oh, I'm going to do a couple of these, and then the right person's going to see me, and then I'll get a Broadway show, and then I'll get a TV show, and then I'll be a movie star. That's the way it goes, right? And now it's like totally backwards. Right. Now you have to be a movie star, then you get a TV show, and then you get a Broadway show when you're off. Right.
And then you move to an intimate space on the Lower East Side.
Correct.
So you got Stomp. What did you do at Stomp?
Well, that's a cast of eight and eight percussionists, and one of those eight people is a character named Mozzie, who's the funny guy, and that's the part I was, the funny guy.
So you did all the dancing and the percussion elements also?
All of it, yes. I mean, I played drums since I was a kid, but I have better sense of rhythm than I actually do in executing, like on a drum set. Uh-huh. But when I'm playing on a can, I can do that. When I'm playing a bunch of paint scrapers or a broom, I got it, because I understand, you know, music and timing and all that stuff. It wasn't easy. I mean, I was online at the West Beth. It was when they had the open call. There were probably, I don't know, 800-900 people there.
Wow.
It was freezing cold. You know, it was that thing, showing up at 5:30 in the morning and, like, paying your dues and standing there and being cold. And then it got narrowed down, and I kept getting narrowed down and narrowed down and narrowed down. And then it was, like, down to, like, whatever, 15 people, and then I didn't get the show. Then they called me back a few months later and for this one specific role, and I didn't get that show. I didn't get that job. Then they called me back 3 months later, and I didn't get it again. And then, like, a month and a half later, they called and said, you're starting tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
So I learned – usually you learn the show in 8 weeks. I learned it in three. And then, boom, I was on the road for a year and a half.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was great. So I did 65 U.S. cities. Then I did South America for 3 months.
Oh, wow.
Where we were, like, big celebrities. We had bodyguards. We were on TV shows. It was so great. Did it at the Orpheum for a while more. Then I left the show. Then they asked me to come back a year later just to do some extra Christmas shows, and I stayed for another 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So it was, without a doubt, one of the best experiences of my life. It was great.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
And also, such a great story of, like, perseverance and not losing hope.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just knew I belonged in that show, you know, and it's so based on personality that – It took them a while to find out what my personality was, because my audition personality is one of fear and loathing. And my real life personality is I can do whatever I want.
Right.
So, yeah. And, you know, I learned a lot doing that show too, because, you know, there's no speaking. And when you're on the road, I remember playing, like, the Fox Theater in St. Louis, which I think is about 2,800 seats. It's a massive cavern of a theater. And the funny guy has a lot of stuff that he just does by himself, literally nobody else on stage. And I learned how to, like, play to the person with the cheapest seat in the house, you know.
That's a real skill.
It was, yeah, it was, it took a while, you know, just using your face. I mean, I watched a lot of Harold Lloyd. he was sort of my inspiration for it. And I actually use Harold Lloyd, like, in all of my comedy classes now. Like, the first thing people watch is Harold Lloyd, because to me, he's the perfect example of what comedy is, of, you know, of wanting to achieve something and not having the ability or the skills to achieve that thing. And then the attempt, you know, the comedy comes out of the attempts of this person trying and trying and trying. And that's what the character was in Stomp as well.
Wow. So what came after Stomp?
Well, sort of in between Stomp was doing the theater sports and the character witness and the cabaret show. It was all sort of tied in together, because I'm not capable of doing one thing at a time, it seems. And then I got into the voiceover world, which feels weird to be saying while I'm talking into a microphone. And then that just kept me really busy, because back in the old days, you know, we'd have like 5 to 10 auditions a day. So that just became your job, was running around to auditions.
Yeah.
And then I guess, I don't even know if this brings us up to like 2005. I suppose it does. Was when this idea to write a musical came about.
Had you ever written a musical or anything like that before? I guess the cabaret shows are musical, so there's elements
totally,
of music in there.
Yeah, absolutely, because they told a story. It was it was aiming for the song. It was always like the dialogue and the need and the want is going, and then I have to sing because it was all like that, but sort of disguised as a typical cabaret show. And then I guess I was writing, like, we also spun off the character witness show into a public access show, so I did a lot of writing for that. But no, I'd never written anything like a musical. I mean, I'd written Hollywood Nurses, but I co-wrote that. And that was, like I said about recycling, Hollywood Nurses is literally, it's an homage to lesbian pulp novels. So my writing partner and I read probably 50 lesbian pulp novels and just pulled every single trope we could from those to create that. So it's just always been my way to kind of use one type of source material and reimagine it in another way.
Mm-hmm. And so say how you came to think that you should apply the same craft to Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, if I could be a fly on the wall and watch myself go through that process, that fly would have his own show. Well, I mean, I talk about this in the first 5 minutes of Desperately Seeking the Exit, which is the show that's about the making of Desperately Seeking Susan. But it was as simple as this. It was just listening to Blondie music one day and going, every one of their songs is about wanting something. Musicals are about people wanting things. I need to listen to more of their music. Every song seems like perfect for a musical. They don't write I hate you songs. They write I want you songs. Mm-hmm. That's it. Maybe it should be like based on some old movie, because back in 2005, that seemed to be the trend that was happening. Things were, their jukebox musicals were trending and adaptations were trending.
So familiar.
So familiar. It's like what Mamma Mia has on their tagline. You already know you're going to love it.
Right.
Why not? Right. Great. And then just spent a bunch of months really breaking down the story, the film Desperately Seeking Susan, with researching like crazy all of Debbie Harry's history and past, and setting the show back in 79, and then researching a lot about what the world was like in 79. And wound up having this treatment that made sense and brought it into a big Broadway producer's office, and she signed on the dotted line, like literally on the spot. And then within a matter of months, there was a Tony Award-winning director. There was London producers. There was a star. I mean, it was just, you know, you asked, like, this goes back to your question before, like, when you moved to New York from college, what do you expect? I was like, this is exactly the way it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
This is what I'm meant to do.
Right.
Right, of course. This doesn't happen for anybody. Nothing falls into, oh, my God, I've been knocking on doors trying to be an actor all these years. I should have been writing musicals.
Right.
Forest through the trees, I guess.
We don't have to go play by play, since you have a whole performance about that. But
a whole lifetime in 1 hour.
Yes, but it comes together. Like, these people all sign on, you move forward to create this massive production. And so just walk us through that just a little bit.
You know, it was the typical thing that happens. You have a reading in New York. People get excited. So they go, okay, let's go to the next step. The next step is a workshop. Our workshops just happened to be in London, which was great. Three workshops over the course of a year and a half. Each workshop better and better. Buzz builds. Suddenly you're setting a date for the West End. Now, here's where there was a problem. We probably shouldn't have opened a brand new musical, cold, as they say, on the West End. This doesn't happen very... I think Bullets Over Broadway is maybe one of the most recent examples of something that's opening cold. And again, you know, they've got a pretty good pedigree there. You know?
Right, right,
they're
but
gonna
it's
do
rare.
It, they're going to do all right. But it is really rare. And a theater just became available, and timing and schedule. You know, it's a weird thing that happens when you're involved in this process. Everything happens really fast, and nothing is happening fast enough.
Yeah.
You know? And we all got so excited about it because people really genuinely loved every workshop that they came to. I mean, of course, there were problems, but those problems were easily fixable because we knew the music worked, and we knew that the story of Desperately Seeking Susan worked. It's a classic, timeless, simple story.
Yeah.
It was when we actually started the real rehearsal process before opening that it started to fall apart, because that was the first time that we really saw that the entire creative team, both Americans and Brits, were approaching the show from different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't on the same page. So nothing good can come of that. It's just, I mean, theater is about collaboration, period. Like, even a solo show, the best ones have a director. There's some collaboration
right,
there,
right.
You know? So we were just on different pages. And, you know, as I say in my show, I didn't know what I was doing either, you know? I knew how to adapt the material for the stage. I knew I had to raise the stakes. I knew I had to beef up certain characters that they'd have a reason to sing. I knew where the big dance numbers should be, the way they fall in, you know, musicals. We weren't reinventing the wheel.
Right. It's a recipe.
It's a recipe. It is. Yeah. Yeah. And I knew that recipe because I'd seen 10 billion musicals and didn't just watch them. I always thought about them and read books about them and wondered why and how and what is the formula. And
what was your first inkling that something might not be going the way you expected?
Oh, my gosh. I so wish I knew. I really wish I knew. The first inkling was when I was asked not to come to rehearsals for the first 3 weeks. I thought that was a miss. But I can also see why a director would say that. You know, they need their time with the cast to do their thing. I didn't expect to show up 3 weeks later and see that, you know, large portions of the book had been rewritten, or that the actions, the stage directions that I had very clearly written were completely ignored. Now, look, I don't expect, you know, you to read the italics, as they say. You don't have to read, he goes stage left. I wasn't writing stuff like that.
Right.
But I was writing stuff that kind of helped tie the scenes together because, like I said, I think very visually. So I knew I was creating a different kind of world, you know, I wasn't just writing dialogue. Mm-hmm. I was creating a show. And it just was not jumping off the stage the way I had expected.
And when you're involved in something where you feel like it's headed in the wrong direction, I'm often curious about this because I attend shows with some regularity where I wonder, didn't anyone realize what was happening here? Like that things were going awry? And so are you trying during those moments, because it sounded like you had some foresight to recognize that things seemed to be going in a direction that you didn't think would be successful. And so Are you like ringing the bell? Are you pulling the emergency lever? Are you just trying to get it so that it works as best it can? Or what's actually happening during those build-up moments?
That's a great question. You know, what happened for me was I was told very early on by our original Tony Award-winning director that the writer of the musical is the lowest man on the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
And having been involved in a show that's been running for 10 years and that's very successful that this director directed, and having been involved in that process because of just mutual friends and such, I saw that to be true. I saw that writer of that huge running for 10 years musical was at the bottom of the totem pole.
But you weren't just the writer. You were,
I was the conceiver.
Conceiver too,
yeah, I actually
bigger thing.
We worked really, my lawyer worked really hard to make sure I would always be credited as written and conceived by. I mean, God, now I regret those. I regret those hours that I paid him to get me that title. Because then it's like, you're fully responsible for
and
this.
And the blame is all yours.
Totally, totally. Because I did think it was a new concept.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, other than like Tommy, you know, which actually started out as a concept album and then became a movie and then became a musical.
Right.
It was sort of already built in to be a musical. This is like, wait a minute, guys. This is mashing up two completely different properties. This is an original concept. You know, sometimes the idea is better than the product, you know? I mean, it happens a lot. I'm sure you see stuff, too, where you're like, that's a great idea.
Yeah, oh, sure.
It's just not – it's not – touching people, it's not moving people, it's not entertaining even.
You know
this happens. I mean, I work in the solo show world a lot too, and sometimes that you hear the phrase, you know, just because it happened to you doesn't mean it's interesting.
Oh my God, I wish I had that on a t-shirt.
You know, I do think everyone has their own story, and I do think that everything that happens to everybody is interesting. It's the way that you present that that makes it interesting or not.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So I interrupted you. You were saying you're the low man on the totem pole. You see things are going a little awry.
So there was that. I also was a novice, right? Yep. So I couldn't say, well, when I did this show, I never was told. I was also an American working in London. I am a guy from Queens. I have big opinions. I like to say what's on my mind. The British culture doesn't really work that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy that they're having me there. So I did not protest too much.
Mm-hmm.
My British producers might disagree, but what I always tell them, and we're all still friends, what I say to them now is, yes, but can you imagine what I would, what I, you don't know what I wanted to say.
Right.
You know, I'm proud that I walked out of one meeting. If this was New York, every creative will have walked out of at least 10 meetings. You know, it's just, it's so different. So I just felt like I didn't want to rock the boat anymore.
Yeah.
And I fought for stuff and it got trashed. And then there was stuff I fought for that in retrospect I probably shouldn't have, because maybe it wasn't the best choice. But like I said, again, it's the forest through the trees. You're just so happy to see your baby walking that you don't care that it's, you know, got a tail, that your baby is cross-eyed, you know, that, you know, it's walking.
So fast forward, it opens. The opening doesn't go that well. The reviews are not that positive. About a month later, it closes.
Correct.
What was that like?
The worst.
Yeah.
It was the worst. It was exactly the stages of grief. What are there, 40? I don't know.
And they run on an infinite loop.
They do, and they could be out of order and all that, but... when the producer called me, I was in the middle of, I was seeing a film at the end, Angelica or something, and the phone rang. I was like, that's weird. Why are they calling me? I think I might have had an inkling too, because right around 2007, I remembered like they asked me in 2006 to get on this thing called Facebook, which was a little bit bigger over there because of the university.
Uh-huh.
That's how it all started, you know? And there was like a page for Susan, and I was the voice of Susan. You know, hey guys, going out tonight to the Peppermint Lounge or whatever, you know, just making up this weird 1979 lingo that nobody in London understood or cared about. But I saw one of the associate director put something on Facebook like, things don't look good.
Oh.
And I just knew that meant not good. And I got the stage manager's reports every single night. And it wasn't like the audience was diminishing. The size of the audience was diminishing at all. But I knew it wasn't, you know, packing the house like Mamma Mia was, like we expected at the Novello Theater. But it was always the reaction is great, standing ovation, you know, it was great stuff. But there was an inkling. I also knew, like, they never pulled any of the good quotes. There were no good pull quotes anywhere in any ad ever at all after it opened. So what do you, you know, how, why are you, you know,
yeah.
I remember going, so then I flew back for the final show and like, you know, there I am outside the Novello Theater where all the giant pictures of the, you know, the photo, the production shots are in these beautiful big glass cases. And like, they just had must close across them. There was never any like great review pull quote. And there were, I mean, I actually created a pull quote sheet that I sent to, you know, here's me sending pull quote sheets to De Winter and the people who were doing the marketing and the advertising for the show. That's how desperate, no pun intended, I was to, like, keep it going.
Why do you think they didn't pull the quotes and do the marketing?
I don't know. I think the marketing was weird from the beginning. You know, I just think people didn't know about it. People didn't really seem to know about it. You know, we didn't really have Blondie kind of like championing.
It's a difficult word.
It's going to make that word up, guys. It's early and it's Sunday. Championing the show the way maybe ABBA did.
Yeah.
You know, or the Elvis Presley estate did for All Shook Up, or the Beach Boys did. They, you know, they're a cool band. They just kind of approached it cool. Yeah, we think it's a great idea. It's looking good. We're excited. It wasn't like, yeah, you know. So we, and then there was a great divide. There were many divides. The one divide is, why is this American musical opening here on our West End?
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the, you know, why is this not original? Why is it based on something? Why is this a jukebox musical? The Madonna fans were not happy because we weren't using Madonna's music, which was never a consideration because she does not write want songs. The Blondie people were not happy because we were using Madonna's movie.
Right.
It was only like the market was really small for people who just were like really curious to see it. The only market we had were like the, ooh, let's see how bad it's going to be.
Oh.
You know?
The hate watchers.
But, you know, there were also many times where I always sat in the same spot in one of the box seats and I watched the audience. I didn't need to watch the show. Where you'd see like this lovely ballad happening on stage and you'd see like a couple hold each other's hands, or I'd hear like a little girl tell her mother in the lobby like, Mom, I want to see it again. Can we come back again? You know, there was always that. And I became friends with many people who were big fans of the show and came back, and people dressed up as Madonna and people dressed up as Blondie. But it just didn't have any, just the excitement wasn't there. It was also a pretty crowded theater season. We had Lord of the Rings playing down the street from us. We had the Buddy Holly show coming back for the 18 millionth time. There was another big musical at the time that was kind of, I think, Hairspray was just opening, so that was getting a lot of press as well. It just fell under the radar.
So quickly to wrap this part of the story up, but then it goes to Japan where it's a huge hit.
Shocking, yes. I spent a year after it closed in my house, not leaving, not talking, not writing, not doing anything, except for approving these translation notes that I would get from this company in Tokyo that was putting the show on. And then I found out that the Toho company, was like one of the biggest producers in Japan. I mean, they created the rail system that runs through Japan many, many, many years ago. Then they created Godzilla, and now they bring a lot of American musicals over. And I got flown over, went to a few techs, gave some notes, and was completely blown away when, after opening night, the audience leapt to their feet and the cast had to bow 5 times. And especially when my translator, because it was all in Japanese, my translator says, this never happens in Tokyo. People don't get up. They love your show.
Wow.
And it got great reviews and it had a nice long run. I mean, for Tokyo standards, they don't do Broadway type runs. 4 months is enough.
Yeah.
And we just thought, oh great, now it's okay. This guy found the vision. This is what the show should look like. This is how it should move. This is the show. It was supposed to move to Korea, and then Korea kind of had their financial meltdown, and then it just died.
Mm-hmm.
And after X amount of time, with a property like this, when you're dealing with MGM and Chrysalis Records and music publishers, after X amount of time, half the rights resort back to the writer-creator and half the rights resort back to the other people. So the other people decided that was it.
Yeah. Okay. But despite your year of depression, you somehow managed to come through it all and create something else.
Well, we do. I mean, that's the great thing about life, is that it's full of ups and downs. I was up for a really good long time because I have a musical on the West End. Then that was like paired with, I had a really crappy year where I was really down. It happened in Tokyo. I was back up. I was down then because I knew the musical was going to be hard to get it mounted again. And then somehow was transferring all of my blog, because I, you know, like a good writer, and thinking that someday there'd be a coffee table book about the show because it was going to be such a big hit. They would be asking, what are your notes? So I would take notes every night.
They'd be in a museum somewhere.
Something. So I had this blog. I had to transfer it off of one server to another. And in the process, I read the blog and I was like, oh my God, this is a great story. Oh, this is my story. So that's when I decided to turn it into a show.
And how did that happen?
Not easily. I did not want to tell my own story, although I teach solo shows and I've, certainly had my share of doing other types of spoofy shows. I'd never really done a storytelling show, and I didn't want to do a woe is me show, and I had a really hard time getting rid of all the bad feelings I had about the show.
How did you do that? Because I've seen your one-person show. I didn't ever see the original, and I was actually amazed by the way that you tell the story in what, seems to me, an audience member, to be like very level-headed and very fair to all the parties involved while still expressing your own disappointment and sort of, hurt feelings over the process. But at the end, I'm kind of amazed. So I'm very interested in knowing how it is you work through all that to come out to where you are.
Well, thank you. There are a few steps. I mean, the first draft of it was, am I allowed to swear on this?
Yes. Say
the first draft was called Fuck London. So that lets you know like where I was at. I shelved that. That went away. And then I pulled a little bit from that when then it was called Bloody Holiday. For reasons, I don't even know what's the point? Let's just say when you're under a lot of stress, sometimes you get bloody in places that you don't expect.
No.
I think I touch upon it a little bit in the show. I just knew, I had to tell I had to make it a comedy because that's what I like to do. Mm-hmm. So I was actually in London where I teach there twice a year. I teach the Actor Center, like improv and comedy and stuff. And I was out with one of my comedy mentors named Steve Kaplan, who taught me a lot ever since I moved to New York. And he said, change your title. And right away the title came up, Desperately Seeking the Exit, which is what Charles Spencer from The Telegraph said about the show, his time at the show. Right away that winks and nods at like, okay, I'm in on it.
Yeah.
But he's, what Steve said is basically I had to put myself back in the place I was then, not what I learned from it. So then I was optimistic and happy and thrilled and excited and couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go, oh, that's a weird, I'm not allowed for 3 weeks. I'll go shopping. I'll learn about London. I'll see other shows. Great. That's how I was.
Right.
It wasn't until, a year later, I was like, what the hell? How dare you not tell me I can't be at my own show? So writing it from the lens of being there at that time, I believe, is what makes it a comedy.
That's interesting.
And then also, I had the great fortune of working with John Clancy, who started the New York Fringe Festival, which is actually where we met. I was sort of an intern trading, doing files for him while I got free rehearsal space. And we always knew we loved each other's aesthetic, and he comes from a very different aesthetic than I do, but we both appreciated it. And he, one of his shows that he wrote is called The Event, which gets done every so often all around the world. And it's a great sort of like deconstruction of a one-person show. And it really touched me in a way that I knew for this I wanted to do something similar. So we started talking about how can the show be presented and written in a way that's sort of more like stand-up and improv and storytelling rather than the I was born one-man show, that kind of storytelling. And doing it in Edinburgh, I premiered it in New York in a tiny little basement where I still do the show. But just doing it in a bar, you learn a lot. I mean, people are drinking. They want to talk back. And I said, oh, this is what this show is. This is how it feels. Then doing it for 24 shows in a row in Edinburgh, where you're not doing it for your friends.
Yep.
You're doing it for Brits, Scots, Americans, and everything in between. You learn a lot about storytelling and working with the audience and what works and what doesn't work. So the show is literally different every single night. And then from there on in, it just sort of kept rolling out and I just kept doing it and doing it. I mean, there's people who have seen the show, I don't know, 5 or 6 times because they say it's different every single time.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the same way, like where I've seen shows over and over. You know what's going to happen at the end. Like, you know that they're going to have to leave Anatevka, but you're still praying that somehow they'll be able
this
to stay.
It will be different. I totally know.
And
what
I think that's
about.
What happens with the audiences for Exit. They're like, we know going in. I mean, that's actually changed the show. When I first started the show, you know, there's a joke about very early on in the show about. So I decided to write a musical, and now I kind of go, whoops, you know, because everyone who's coming to the show already knows this is going to be about how it failed. But when right. it first started, it was like, I'm going to write a musical. Let's see what happens. People yep. didn't know it was yep. all going to fall apart.
Surprise.
Yeah, surprise.
There's no surprise ending now.
There's no surprise. I keep wishing there's going to be a surprise. Like,
we all do.
I can't wait to like reveal some great new news about the show. But there is no news about the show.
So what else? What else is next?
You know, I get my hand in directing a lot of solo stuff, so I'm still busy. I work a lot at the Pit. Mm-hmm. I work sometimes at Ars Nova. Not doing the Edinburgh Festival this year. Started working on a show to bring to Edinburgh, but very early on just felt it wasn't right and it wasn't going to be ready. If you're going to do anything in the Edinburgh Festival where there's 2,800 shows and the world's eyes are on you, it better be really good, especially because you're investing quite a few thousand dollars to do it.
Well, and I was there this last year, and I heard this crazy statistic, something like the average size of the audience per show is like 3 people.
You know, did I read that somewhere recently too?
I don't know how that, I mean, I assume what that means is that you just have a lot of shows that basically just... old or something.
Well, you do because there's so much competition.
There's
so many. It's so hard to get to have your voice be heard there.
Yes.
And a lot of people go like with no preparation. Like they start their Twitter account the first day of the Fringe. Just because you're putting it out there doesn't mean anyone's listening.
This is not a build it and they will come
it's
situation.
It's not.
This is like work your fingers to the bone scrape together each personalized invitation to each audience member.
Absolutely. You have to be out hustling every single day. And, you know, most of all, your show has to be fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
You have to love your show.
Because you're going to do it every day for a month, which I can't even imagine. I'm not a performer, but just in the abstract, I can't doing that.
It's a great training.
Oh,
I'll tell
sure.
you. But, you know, doing 8 shows a week of Stomp is that prepares you for that, too.
Sure.
And how do I make this show special? We always said that 12. If you have 12, you had a good show. The first year, I had tons of press. I had 4- and 5-star reviews coming out really early on. I hustled my butt off. I was on every talk. I mean, it was crazy. But I still had like an average of maybe 20 people per show. When I went back last year, I maybe hustled a total of 3 hours the whole summer, like handing out postcards. I didn't really hang up posters. My publicist and I didn't really push to get more interviews. And I had standing room only 75% of the time.
But that's because you had built that goodwill
the prior season. That's exactly it. And it was also, you know, it was more like I built a brand.
Yep.
And I also had the great fortune of the show running for a month in London. I mean, a lot of people say, like, what's the point of doing a show in Edinburgh if you're only going to have an audience of 12 or you're going to lose all your money? Well, for me, the point was a producer picked up my show and gave me a month-long run in the Leicester Square Theatre in London. That would never have happened on my own.
I thought that was basically the point of Edinburgh, actually,
well,
from a performer's perspective.
I think it
is. In addition to the training and the experience and all that, is that you're hoping that an artistic director is going to see your show and invite you to perform
there.
Well,
look, that's the difference. You can hope that that's going to happen, but what you're there to do is to make that happen.
Right, right.
You have to know what you're going there for. I knew the first year I was going, I just wanted press.
Uh-huh.
I didn't try to get producers. I just wanted press,
I see.
That's what I got. And you know, it's funny, I'm doing Exit again on the 22nd and 23rd because I need to get some more New York press because I'm bringing the show to Orlando. Something tells me that a 5-star review from Australia isn't going to mean as much in Orlando, and this is nothing against Orlando, but it's not going to mean as much in Orlando as a great review from New York.
Right.
It's just because it's New York. It's just, it's America. It's, you know, it's here. The 5-star review from Australia works great in, you know, Scotland and Ireland and Australia. But I'm going into it knowing I mean, I'm doing the show again because I love to do the show because there's still hundreds of people, of friends of mine who haven't seen it. Hello, people. But I need to – I want to get the show back on track for Orlando so it has a good run there. I haven't figured out why I'm doing Orlando, you know, and I want to figure that out.
Because like, it's warm there.
Well,
and it's
it is
cold
warm.
There.
There's Disney, and I've heard terrific things about that festival as well. I mean, cool. It's the longest running fringe festival in America, which
really?
I only found out the other day. They're great people. I met them at Edinburgh last year and just fell in love with them both as people. We'll see. You know, I think this business is very hard. It is a business, but like any business, you have to set a goal, but things are going to happen along the way, positive and negative, that are going to change the route to get to that goal. So I think if you just keep putting it out there, eventually something's going to happen. You know, I had a friend recently say, you know, nobody came to my last show. I tweeted about it. I Facebooked about it and nobody came to it. Last night I had a friend who's had a sold out show and he said, I didn't do anything. And everybody came to the show tonight. And that sort of is what's happening because he keeps doing it.
Yeah.
And so I just keep doing Exit. And who knows if the right – and, you know, the great thing is people have seen Exit and they go, oh, my God, I want to see this musical so bad. And hopefully eventually that will translate into it happening. But
has it ever been performed here in the U.S.?
No. No.
So is that sort of the long-term vision that you'd like to see a production
here? It is.
Here?
Broadway is not the vision at all.
Right, right.
My perfect place for it to play would be the Paper Mill Playhouse. I think that would be a great place for it because it's New Jersey and it's New York. It's right there. But I think that this is the kind of show that regional theaters, high schools, camps, colleges would do with their eyes closed. The audience, they already know they're going to like the music.
Right.
They
it's
already
familiar.
Know the story. It's full of great female characters. There's lots of opportunity for dancing. Everyone loves the 80s. So that's it. So in the meantime, I am working on another jukebox musical because I'm crazy. I was actually listening to some of the music on the way over here today. And I picture how it all comes together on the stage and then start thinking about like how to justify the story and the words to get us to that place. And I don't care that it's a jukebox musical. This is what I do. I like breathing new life into old things.
And so considering what you learned with Desperately Seeking Susan, how will you approach creating this new show differently?
I'll just make sure that the people that are involved are on the same page as I am and then learn from them.
Mm-hmm. This has been so great.
We love everything you do, Lindsay. This is, Maxima is great. It's a pleasure for me. I feel like I'm a celebrity today on this Sunday morning.
Oh, there you go. All right. So you mentioned that you have shows coming up at the Triple Crown this Saturday and Sunday at 8 p.m. And then you're going to the Orlando Fringe.
Yeah. And I should say that the shows have always been, thanks to learning this in Edinburgh, pay what you want. I don't even know how much you put in my bucket. I won't look.
You're not
I don't
keeping
care.
A secret list.
It's all right. Uncle Sam doesn't know. That's nice, too. There's going to be lots of free candy. Have you been to London Candy around the corner?
No, but I've had the candy at your show.
Oh, you have? Yeah.
Delicious.
People like that. I'm glad I'm doing like a British show and not a Swedish show because their candy is so hard to eat. It's covered in salt.
You know, I personally believe that you can get so much goodwill by giving people like the smallest amount of food or candy. I had a teacher in high school who used to call them edible learning reinforcements, and she would give us each one cinnamon bear.
Every time you did something good?
Before an exam.
Wow.
That was so funny.
Wow.
She later killed herself. It's a sad story, actually.
No.
Sorry.
On that note, the church bells are ringing. This is the most depressing end of an interview we've ever done.
I'm sorry. I should not have added that detail. I don't know why I don't know why I felt compelled to do that.
You know what? If you ever want to write a one-woman show about this memory, I'm the guy to come to.
You know what? I actually have a really funny story that I think would make a great – I don't know about a one-woman show – but a great storytelling event, like a moth style story. I actually the other day wrote it down because I was like, this story is so funny. No one would believe this actually happened. But then I also have the fear of just because it happened to you doesn't make it interesting.
You'll make it interesting. As long as you give out cinnamon barrels to the audience when the show starts, they're going to love you.
I don't know if you'll like me, but I know you'll love these mini Snickers.
Exactly. That's the way. See, you know. This Broadway show needs to give out more cinnamon barrels
oh my God,
to their
that's
audience
so
and
true.
To their to the reviewers.
Oh, well, that would be a massive conflict of interest.
It's all a conflict of interest at this point. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows everyone. A deep sigh. We've just turned a corner, listeners. This is getting deep.
Disclosure, transparency, all critical.
It is. You know what you learn, though? What I learned over there in Europe was like the press loves to actually know you as a person. The critics want to talk to you before they come see your show and review you.
Interesting.
I think it's like that here too. And I just think that some of us as producers and performers are afraid to embrace that because we're afraid that they're not going to like our stuff.
Right.
So what happens when I get chummy with blah, blah, blah from blah, blah, blah publication and then they see me and they don't like me? What was the point of that? Well, there's something there. They like you as a person. There's something there. And maybe the next time they'll be more willing to. I think there should be. It's ridiculous to pretend that there's no dialogue going on between Broadway producers and the New York Times who are reviewing them.
Oh, yeah, that's...
It's not. I mean, people aren't showing up with masks on their faces, hiding their identity.
I mean, they're getting free tickets. They're getting the best seats in the house. I mean, these are all elements of wooing them.
They're all in the same restaurants. They all see each other. Good or bad, you've got to say hello.
Yeah.
We're just people. We're on this planet for such a short amount of time. Let's just talk to people and get to know people and just deal with it.
There you go.
We're so tiny.
That was a much better note to end on.
Good.
Good job.
We turned it around again.
Way to rescue the podcast.
Terrific.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Maximu Podcast. I'd love to hear what you think about this format and whether there are other artists you would love to hear interviewed. Tweet to us at Maximu. That's M-A-X-A-M-O-O. You can find Pete on Twitter at Blackout Pete. That's B-L-A-C-K-O-U-T-P-E-T-E. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens, LindSayBarenz. See you next week.